We're still trying to get some kind of a ski thing together, but doesn't look too good right at this point. In terms of spending a couple days, but maybe we're going to... Yes?
You might be thinking about that condo in Breckenridge?
Yeah, but he said it was too small.
Yeah, he said it wasn't helpful.
Yeah, it wasn't big enough. We still have some other people looking, so maybe it will materialize yet. Now, we don't have too much to go in the Song of Solomon. We're almost down to the wire. We only have three chapters. And might be that we might even finish next week. So we're getting close to the end of this book. Now, chapter 5 ended with the Shulamite woman relating a dream to the daughters of Solomon's harem. And in this dream, they responded to her with a question, a couple questions about her shepherd lover. And chapter 6 opens with one of those questions. Whither is thy beloved gone, O fairest among women? These are the daughters of the harem, part of the Solomon's harem. Whither is thy beloved turned aside, that we may seek him with you? Okay? And she says, my beloved is going down into his garden, into the beds of spices, to feed in the gardens and to gather lilies. I am my beloved is mine, he feedeth among the lilies. And those are little, what are called the agricultural or pastoral trophies. They're figures of speech. They're sort of memories that she had of the pastoral life that they shared together in the hills of Galilee. Now, one of the things that we wanted to point out, or that we did point out last week, was the confidence that the Shulamite woman had and that he had in her. That's expressed in verse 3. I am my beloved's, and my beloved is mine. He feeds among the lilies. Okay? Okay, let's get a principle right here. What was the last principle we had? I'm not... Which one? Okay, so we're ready for 22? Okay, principle number 22, and these principles have to do... What's the matter? Do we got a light on? Oh, that's just that blood. These principles have to do with dating and courtship and so on. Principle 22. Okay. Enduring one another on a date or in the courtship process is miserable. Okay? Now, the idea simply is this. Right man, right woman will have the capacity to enjoy one another in courtship. That is, while they're dating, they are going to like to be together. Okay? So that then kind of leads to a certain confidence, like she expresses in verse 3 of chapter 6, which will make principle number 23. Principle number 23. Before you commit yourself to marriage, you should have the utmost confidence. You should have the utmost confidence. And this is what this gal has. See, she's engaged. Like the Shulamite woman. that you are right man, right woman. Okay? Now, there was just no doubt in this girl's mind about that, and that sort of protected her, see, from Solomon's advances. He is very aggressive in this book, trying to get her into his harem, but he's very unsuccessful, and one of the reasons he's unsuccessful is that this gal has the utmost confidence in her shepherd lover, and he also in her. In other words, there is security in the relationship that the girl has. She's not insecure. She's not getting married to the guy to make the relationship secure. The relationship is already secure, you see. Okay? So what we're saying here is a security develops in the relationship. Okay. Now, Solomon now enters the scene again in the middle of chapter 6, in verse 4. And he is going to, talk about the Shulamite woman, and every time he talks about her, he talks about her description of her physical characteristics. So here he's going to give Now remember that she's been putting him off. She's been rejecting him. So he has to start feeling this rejection syndrome that he's in, see? So he's going to turn on all the charm that he has. He's struck with her beauty, see? And so he now has a passionate outburst and makes another pitch. So verse 4, they're the words of Solomon. And again, he's trying to inveigle her, tempt her into his harem. Thou art beautiful, O my love, as Tirzah. Now, Tirzah was a charming little town in northern Palestine. It wasn't too far from where Shulam was, where this woman lived. Samaria, that part of Palestine, is like the hills in Missouri. Lots of foliage, lots of trees, enough moisture. It's kind of pretty, okay? And so he says, you're like the charming village of Tirzah. You are comely, or as beautiful as Jerusalem. You are terrible as an army with banners. Now the word terrible there means she's sort of majestic, see? She sort of has a royal look about her. If you get the idea of horses riding with banners, and these banners are what they used to lead the armies with, see? And they were very majestic, okay? So she had this majestic military style about her, and that's what he meant. You are terrible as an army with banners. Now her eyes are flashing, see? And she has these dark eyes, and she's had her stomach full of Solomon. She's ready to really tell him off, okay? So in verse 5, he says, turn away your eyes from me, for they have overcome me. Now her eyes are flashing, see? She's angry, okay? The word here for overcome is a word that means you have you really knocked me down with your eyes. You've really abashed me. You've awed me. In Hebrew, there's a way of saying by the verb, you cause something to be. And that's what the verb is here. You caused by your eyes me to be abashed, is what he said. So he is really struck. She is glaring at him, see? Okay? So he says, turn away your eyes from me. She's angry. Now let's put a principle down there, okay, about the eyes, because okay, thank you. This is principle number 24. Principle number 24. Okay. The eyes are the windows The eyes are the windows of the soul. The eyes are the windows of the soul. Okay? Okay. The Shunammite woman repelled Solomon with her eyes. Okay? She never promised him anything with her eyes. She didn't flirt with him, see? And she's very, very angry now, see? So she just gives him, she stones him, see? She just looks at him and her eyes are angry. Okay? So he says, turn away your eyes. But Solomon's aggressive now. He's going to continue to push his case. Look at verse 5. Turn away your eyes from me, for they have caused me to be overcome. Your hair is as a flock of goats that appear from Gilead. Your teeth are, the flock of goats here are the black goats from Mount Gilead. So she had a real black raven here. She's already told us this before, hasn't he? Your teeth are as a flock of sheep which go up from the washing. In other words, they're clean. Every one beareth twin. That meant that they lined up. Okay. She had a good bite in her mouth. She had a good firm setting of her jaw. And her teeth were indicative of this. See. There is not one barren among them. As a piece of pomegranate are thy temples within thy locks. So that the temples there are her cheeks. See. And her hair, there's a symmetry in her bone structure, and her hair came in around her cheeks, see? So she had real fluffy black raven hair. And she was kind of breathtaking to look at, really a beauty, okay? Okay, now all of a sudden, in the middle of that, Solomon lapses in to a braggadocio about his harem. Look, verse 8. There are 70 queens and 80 concubines. 70 would be how many? 60. 80 concubines? 80. And virgins without number. The virgins were the daughters of the harem. So what Solomon actually is doing, you see, is bragging about his record as sort of a lover. He says, look at my harem. In verse 9 he says, my dove, my undefiled is but one. And that's the Shulamite woman. She is the only one of her mother. She is the choice one of those of her that bear. The daughters of the harem saw her and blessed her. Yea, the queens and the concubines, they praised her. So she was really outstanding, see? And he tried to get her into the harem. Well, let's put a principle down. Let's note this first about Solomon, okay? In verse 9, Solomon brags about his harem. And here he is talking to the Shulamite woman, see? And he's going to compare her with the rest of this harem. So he said he had queens. Now the queens, of course, we said would be his wives. 60 wives. Just think of Solomon trying to say goodnight to all of those wives. What a mess he had on his hands. Okay? These were wives. He had concubines. Concubines. 80. Now an 80 was not a concubine was not a wife. She was like a plaything. So he had 80 playthings. Okay? And then he had the virgins. Now these were the attendants, see? These are without number. Counted attendants, and they were like young virgin girls who were pretty and potentials, and we called all of this Haremsville, see? Now you remember the passage we looked at the beginning in 1 Kings chapter 11 verse 3. There it said that when Solomon completed all of this, he had 700 wives and 300 concubines. 1 Kings 11:3. We don't know if he had this many when the Song of Solomon was written, but at least near the end of his life, he had 700 wives and 300 concubines. Okay? And in order to pay for all of that, he had to very heavily tax the people. He just became a terrible, terrible leader, see? And God had to take the kingdom really away from Solomon. And one of the reasons God did it, we're told in 1 Kings, is because Solomon followed his lust patterns for women, and they completely perverted his soul. Okay? Now let's pick up another principle, okay? Principle number 25. Principle 25. This relates to Solomon's braggadocio. Principle number 25. Comparative wooing. Does that make sense to you? Comparative wooing, or suppose you go out with a guy and he tells you about all the girls that he's been out with. And he's saying, you're prettier than all the girls I've been out with. Did you know I went out with so-and-so, and then last week I was out with so-and-so, but you're really prettier. Or suppose a girl goes out with a guy and she says to the guy, hey, I like you, but last week I was out with the fullback of the football team. He's really something. He's built nicer than you are. But he doesn't have personality you do. There's sort of a comparative, interaction. Comparative wooing is a sign of an immature male or female. Comparative wooing is a sign of an immature male or female. It is the sign of an impressionist. A sign of an impressionist. Now, what is an impressionist? He or she who does this kind of thing tries to impress others with that, with himself or herself. In the sense of numbers, I don't want to use the word lovers, but that's I guess I have to use it. That's not the best word. Daters maybe would be the idea. Number of dates or something to that effect. See what I'm saying? This appears to be what Solomon is doing. He's saying, look, I've got a lot of beautiful dolls around me, but you are really something, and all the girls in the harem recognize how super you are. Okay? Okay. So he ends up the thing by saying, who is she that looketh forth as the morning? Verse 11. Fair as the moon, clear as the sun, and terrible as an army with banners. So he ends his pitch, see, with a question. Her eyes are still flashing. She's still angry. Okay? Okay. Now, these next three verses are probably the most difficult verses in all of the book to interpret. The last three verses of chapter 6. Okay? Okay. This is most likely the relating of the Shulamite woman on how she was sort of inveigled or tempted to get into Haremsville. Now remember, she's not a wife, she's not a concubine. Solomon is trying to make her that, see? So this is the Shulamite woman speaking in verse 11. I went down into the garden of nuts to see the fruits of the valley and to see whether the vine flourished and the pomegranates budded. Now all she's saying is, she went for a stroll in the rural pastoral area in which she lived, and apparently it was time for the various bearing of fruits and so on. And while she was in that, on that walk, verse 12 says, or ever I was aware. Now that means before I knew what was happening, my soul made me like the chariots of Amminadab. Now that doesn't make too much sense. Let me translate the latter part of that verse 12. Here's verse 12, a more literal translation. Before I knew what was happening, before I knew what was happening, okay, my soul, now that would be her emotional bent, see, my soul put me to the chariots of my noble people. Okay. This word chariots, okay? See this over here, this chariots of my noble people? The problem with that is that is that word Amminadab that you see in the King James, if you're reading King James. The last word in the King James leads up is this. Before I was aware, my soul made me like the chariots of Amminadab. Okay? In other words, that word, Amminadab, can be two words. And the King James just takes the two Hebrew words and puts them together and makes it look like a proper noun. It looks like the chariots belong to an individual. If you make it two words, see, here are the words. Chariots, and then we have two words. Nadib, N-A-D-I-B, that's a transliteration of the Hebrew, and then Ami. Okay. You make it two words, and this means chariots of the noble people. If you put Amminadab and put it together and make it one word, it means chariots of the prince of the realm. And who was the prince of the realm? Solomon. Okay. If it would be chariots of the noble people, who would the noble people be? Whose chariots were they? Who would the noble people be? No, not the queens and concubines. Solomon's army, see? In other words, what the gal apparently is saying is that she went for a walk, and in a moment of bewilderment, here are all these chariots parked in the valley, and she walks down into the midst of the chariots, and she's sort of, she's sort of surprised that they're there. It's like, you know, it's like you would get out of you go out of the house, and you say, well, I'm going to go for a walk, and you go for a walk, and all of a sudden there's a great big parade. And you walk into the middle of the parade and you look around. You know, you're sort of struck because you didn't expect that it would be there. So she walks in the middle of that, of those chariots. And apparently what they were part of the entourage or the retinue, or some official courtier of Solomon. See? Now, would somebody read another translation of verse 11 and 12, please? Tell us what translation you're reading. Okay, what are you reading?
It's from the New American Bible.
New American, okay. Verse 11 and 12.
I came down from Nut Garden to look at the fresh growth of the valley. See, the vines were in bloom, the pomegranates had blossomed. Before I knew it, my heart had made me the blessed one of my children.
Okay, before I knew it, my heart had made me the blessed one of my kinsmen. Now that's difficult to get out of Nadib, and the word chariots is definitely chariots, but okay. Another translation. Somebody else got something else? Okay. Dennis? 11 and 12. Oh, homesickness, they translate it. Does that illustrate to you some of the problems there are in the translating of that? I don't know how they would ever get homesickness out of it, because the word for chariots, the word merikibot, is definitely, you know, a towed vehicle. And the idea of some type of royalty is involved, so I don't know how they would get that. Is there another translation? Anybody else? New American? We already had that one. Isn't that the New American? Okay, read the New American Standard. Okay, that's pretty good. That's pretty good. The idea was that she was sort of, she found herself in the midst of this entourage of Solomon. Now, very apparently, Solomon had his, you know, those that were close to him were always looking for another addition to the harem, particularly to the virgin part of the harem. And they apparently inveigled her, or maybe just took her forcefully, and put her into the harem, you see. And remember, when the book opened, they were in an apartment in the northern part of Palestine, of Solomon's, and then they went to Jerusalem. And they're in Jerusalem when this is taking place. So she apparently, in the midst of all of this, or after Solomon's pitch, she related to the daughters of the harem how that she got inveigled into this situation in which we find herself when the book opens. Okay? Okay. Let's keep going. Now, in 6:13, again we have a verse that's hard to interpret because it's in the middle of this sort of a story. Return, return, O Shulamite. Return, return, that we may look upon you. Okay? Now, the one of the problems is who is speaking, you see? Most interpreters believe it's the daughter of the Shulamite woman asking her not to leave. I don't think that's a good Amplify will interpret it that way, but I don't think that's a good translation. I think it is the soldiers in Solomon's entourage that are saying, "Don't run away. Don't run away. We want to look upon you." Okay? Now look at the answer. She says, "What will you see in the Shulamite?" Okay? What will you see in the Shulamite? In other words, she is saying, look, this is a big display of Solomon's power and his wealth, this entourage. What do you guys see in me? I'm just a country girl, is the idea. She's not flirtatious. She's simply saying, I don't know what you would care to see in me. Okay? Now the King James says, as it were, a company of two armies. It really says a company of Mahanaim. Okay, now let's have a little different translation on that. Anybody have a different translation on that? Or does anybody have an Amplified? Would you read the Amplified, anybody? Anybody have that? Would you read it, please, on verse 13? Read louder, please. Read that last part again, Terry. I couldn't hear you. Okay. Anybody else have another translation of that verse? Read the New American Standard, verse 13. Okay. See, Mahanaim can mean like a dance. And the idea would be, we should look upon you because you are very, very graceful. You are something nice to look upon, would be the idea. Well, apparently that little section, which is so hard to interpret, apparently that is the way that she got inveigled, you see, into Solomon's harem. Let's keep going now. Now, the next section is a description of the Shulamite, another physical description. And this apparently is Solomon again. How beautiful are thy feet upon thy shoes, O prince's daughter. The joints of thy thighs are like jewels, the work of the hands of a cunning workman. Okay? Now, the expression here, some interpret this that she's dancing. That's not the case at all. See, they do that on the basis of that previous Mannheim, which could be translated, you're like two dancing girls. It's just simply the idea that that she has a very noble appearance about her. She's fully dressed when Solomon is describing her. Okay? Okay. With respect, should be approached with respect. Okay? And with an intelligent awareness, with an intelligent awareness that God made the woman to complement, complement. What's that kind of complement mean? Pardon? Make him better. That's not exactly what what's this mean? Complement. What's that one? This one we spell complement. What's this mean? Praise, yeah. Compliment, I, means to praise. Complement means what? To add to? Not so much to add to, but to go along with. In other words, to supplement, sort of, is the idea. Okay? So she is made to complement the man. And who did the making but God himself? Okay? In other words, she is his physical counterpart. Okay? By divine design. She is his physical counterpart by divine design. Okay. Her body is to be respected and appreciated from divine viewpoint. Now, Solomon was beyond that, see? Solomon was beyond that. He couldn't appreciate a woman's body from divine viewpoint. He was totally overcome with lust. Okay? Okay. Now, one of the problems that Solomon is going to have is that he will not be able to have optimum enjoyment in sex because of that lust pattern that he's in. All he can think about, again, is the physical aspects of this gal. Okay? Okay, so he's describing her. Thy head, verse 5, upon thee is like Carmel, and thy hair, the hair of thine head like purple. The king is held in thy galleries. In other words, he is just totally enamored of her. He's just totally wrapped up in her. Okay? Okay. So he says, how fair and pleasant art thou, O love, for delights. And all he is thinking about is physical pleasure. See, sexual pleasure. Okay. So, let's get another principle. Solomon's out of it now. But let's get a principle about the issue of sexual compatibility. Solomon thinks it's all physical. Okay? Sexual compatibility. Now, what's compatibility mean? What's compatibility mean? What if you're incompatible? What's that mean? That means you can't get along, okay? So sexual compatibility would be that you had healthy sexual identity. Okay? Sexual compatibility depends upon not so much the physical, watch, but it depends upon these things. Number one, the ability to communicate. Ability to communicate. Okay? Now, we have been reaffirming this all the way through this series. The ability to communicate is a good verbal soul, mind, relationship. And it has nothing to do with the physical, you see. Okay? A person who is incapable of communicating verbally, soul, mind, that person will have difficulty in sexual compatibility in its by divine design, that is, in good compatibility sexually. Okay? Now, you can't have that ability without having a conscience that is clear. A conscience that is clean and clear. Now, this was Solomon's problem. He is so hung up that he can't communicate with this girl, and she doesn't want to communicate with him. She won't have anything to do with the guy. Okay? Okay. The second thing that sexual compatibility depends upon is a willingness to be unselfish in love. In other words, you do not think of yourself so much in the love relationship as you think of your partner in the love relationship. Solomon couldn't do that. All he could think about was himself and his own pleasure. The third thing that sexual compatibility depends upon is an understanding. An understanding of the partner. Okay? Person you're with. Your husband or your wife. Okay? Now look, young couples often use the argument that they're going to have sex together before they're married because they say, how will we know that we're sexually compatible after we get married if we don't practice sex together before we get married? Okay? They will say, we better find out now that whether we're sexually compatible rather than find out after we're married whether we're sexually compatible. And they use that sort of as a rationale or as an excuse to have sex together. And even some Christian young couples do this. That is a terrible mistake. It's mistake number one because, as we said last week, it is always wrong to have sexual relationships outside of marriage, whether you love each other or not. It is always categorically wrong. Okay? It breaks the divine standard, the divine plan. Number two, your sexual compatibility does not depend so much on you physically as it does on this kind of relationship. See what I'm saying? It is a total misconception to think that, to even entertain the idea that you might not be sexually compatible on the basis of some physical problem. That is usually, that is nearly 99 or 999 times out of 1,000 a misconception. If you have this type of a good relationship, you probably can have a compatible relationship sexually. And what is incompatible in the relationships can be worked out. So the fourth point, sexual compatibility depends upon techniques, and these are physical now, learned together. Okay. Okay, now let's take all of these and put a note out in front of them, okay? Let's loop them all together. The ideal setting, to learn sex is in marriage. Okay, now that is by divine design, right? So that you learn the techniques of sex together in marriage, you don't, you know, every young guy, for some reason, I think it's part of our culture, they think that they have to present the image to the girl that they know everything about sex. That's a mistake. It's not true. And mostly what young people learn, apart from divine viewpoint, is usually wrong about sex. They're usually wrong. In other words, they learn the wrong things. Now let me tell you this for in your future, because I don't think any of you are thinking of getting married now, but let me tell you this for in your future, okay? You just mark it down in your mind. There are some of the finest Christian literature now on techniques, sexual techniques, written from a Christian perspective that they have never been on the market before. They're on the market now. I counsel with young couples that are engaged and planning on getting married. And one of the areas that we cover is this issue of sexual relations. And I am now able to give them at least three books that are really super good, really excellent, written totally from a Christian perspective by good people. 10 years ago, I didn't have that. When it came to sexual techniques, I had to give them something written by an unbeliever. And it usually had a lot of human viewpoint in it. So what I'm saying is, sexual compatibility does not depend upon the physical like Solomon is making and like our culture makes it. Sexual compatibility, that is sort of the last step. There are other things that are much more important. Now, any questions anybody might have on that? Okay? Any questions? Okay. Solomon now is, he's making his last, this is his last pitch. Okay? So he says, verse 6, how fair, how pleasant are you, O love, for delights. This thy stature is like a palm tree, and your breast like clusters of grapes. Not grapes, it's really dates. I said, I will go up the palm tree. I will take hold of the boughs thereof. Now also thy breast shall be as clusters of the vine, and the smell of thy nose like apples, and the roof of thy mouth like the best wine for my beloved that goes down sweetly, causing the lips of those that are asleep to speak. And that's the end of Solomon's pitch, and she is going to cut him off right there. He will go no farther. He says that he is going to take her now. And she says, verse 8 is like a resolution. Like, I resolve, I'm going to do this, see? Okay? Okay, she stops him in the midst. She says, I, in verse 10, I am my beloved's, and his desire is toward me. Come, my beloved, let us go forth into the field. Let us lodge in the villages. She wants to go home. She doesn't want to have anything to do with anything more that Solomon has, or his court, or his palace, or the harem. She stops him in a track, right in his tracks, with a finality that discourages him and apparently defeats him. Okay? Now, right there, or right in this context, her shepherd lover is going to show up, and that's where we're going to take up next week. Okay? She is going to go back to northern Palestine. She's going to be rescued at this point and go home. Okay? Any questions we could try to answer? Okay, I think we're going to finish this book next week. I hope you can all be with us, and then I'm going to be going away on a vacation the week after that, so we'll have a break in this teenage class for a while. See you next week, I hope.